In the first part of the program, we witnessed the history of U.S. meddling in Iran, leading up to the coup. In the summer of 1953, the CIA appointed Kermit Roosevelt to carry out a coup d'etat in Iran. The purpose was to overthrow Prime Minister Mossadegh, who had nationalized the Anglo-Iranian Oil Corporation back in 1951, and re-coronate the Shah with full royal power. Stay with us for the rest of the program.
The British had occupied Iran during the Second World War, at which time they placed Mohammad Reza Pahlavi on the throne as Shah, or King. Prior to doing so, they forced the Shah's father, a ruthless strongman, to abdicate the throne due to suspected pro-Nazi sympathies. In placing the son on the throne, the Brits hoped that the younger, weaker Shah would be easier to control.
The Shah was a great coward and a great pipsqueak and a real fraidy cat, very much different from the image that we had of him 20 years later. He was terrified of becoming involved in this operation because he feared, perhaps quite rightly, that if it went wrong, he'd be finished. He'd be chased all out of the country.
This was really dicey up to the last minute. The Shah even didn't think this was going to work. They had to fly his sister in, for example, who was hated and didn't even want to go, to try and convince him to do it.
It took a great deal of persuasion and a lot of pressure by Kermit Roosevelt and a number of people that he brought in to persuade the Shah to join the plot. Now, what did Kermit Roosevelt want the Shah to do? It was his idea that the Shah should sign two orders. Firmans, they're called in Farsi. The first order dismisses Mossadegh as prime minister, and the second order names General Zahedi as his successor. So late one night, around midnight, one of the generals, or colonel at that time, loyal to the Shah, arrived with a few soldiers at Mossadegh's house, bangs on the door, and when the door is opened, says, "I have two orders from the Shah." Now, everyone, including the Shah and Kermit Roosevelt, understood what Mossadegh's reaction to these orders would be. He would say, "These are illegal. I reject these orders. You have no right to name a new prime minister or to fire a prime minister without Parliament's approval." And when he did that, they would arrest him. That was the plan.
That simple plan failed because Mossadegh actually got wind of the plan. So when the Shah's troops came to Mossadegh's home to arrest him, Mossadegh had actually more troops there waiting for them. So they arrested the Shah's colonel.
The next morning, Radio Tehran broadcast the news that a British plot, that's what the Iranians naively thought it was, had been crushed. When the Shah heard this, he fled the country immediately and went to Baghdad and then on to Rome.
The CIA cabled Roosevelt that the situation had become too dangerous and to leave Tehran at once.
Kermit Roosevelt, however, thought to himself, "Wait, I can still do this. I have many assets I haven't used yet. I can still get this done." And showing the resourcefulness for which he became famous, he decided to stay on in Tehran and try 4 days later to stage another coup.
For the next several days, Roosevelt played the role of puppeteer. Throwing Tehran deeper into chaos, he had one gang take to the streets, followed by another. After mullahs marched to denounce Mossadegh, he had the military storm the streets.
They never had any idea that there was such a person as Kermit Roosevelt, and that he was operating in the basement of the U.S. Embassy.
When two Iranian agents working for the CIA got cold feet, Roosevelt made them an offer they couldn't refuse.
Kermit Roosevelt produced a valise with $50,000 in cash. He told them, "If you agree to continue helping me, I'll give you this $50,000. And by the way, if you don't, I'm going to kill you." Considering that option, they changed their mind and decided to help.
Roosevelt knew that the other officers under his control hadn't been touched yet. He had Loy Henderson, the U.S. ambassador, deliver a message to Mossadegh, establish law and order, and clear the streets of demonstrators, or the U.S. would cease to recognize him as prime minister. Henderson falsely claimed that American lives were at risk. Mossadegh fell for the trap and effectively disarmed himself. He ordered his supporters off the streets and established martial law, which allowed the coup plotters to gain access to needed fuel and weapons. The military officers in on the plot then rolled their tanks into Tehran, not to clear the streets of demonstrators, but to arrest Mossadegh. At Mossadegh's residence, there was a final firefight. Mossadegh's men with their three tanks were no match for the 36 tanks that besieged the residence, which was soon destroyed.
Finally, late at night, the firing stopped, the people inside fled, Mossadegh jumped over a back wall and disappeared, the house was looted, they brought out whatever they could find, and some of Mossadegh's personal furnishings were actually for sale on the street. His refrigerator was sold to somebody for about $35. And it was time to deliver the coup de grace. That was the naming of Zahedi.
To head up the coup, the CIA had chosen Bazlollah Zahedi, who had a reputation for ruthlessness. General Zahedi had spent World War II in a British internment camp due to his connections to Nazi agents.
Now, General Zahedi was in the custody, essentially, of Kermit Roosevelt. Roosevelt had stashed him at a safe house near the American embassy. So he arrived there to tell him, everything's worked out, it's all set, you're going to be the prime minister. The guy was just sitting there in his underwear waiting for news. Zahedi was brought out onto the streets and rode aboard a tank through the streets of Tehran to the radio station, where he was to make his statement announcing that Mossadegh was overthrown and I'm now your new prime minister. It was quite a festive event, although there was one hitch. As he was about to make his radio speech, the radio announcers decided we need some martial music to show that Iranian patriotism has finally triumphed.
So he went running off, according to this account, to the embassy library, pulled the first, you know, record album that he could find off the shelf, and immediately put this record on the turntable, and the very first song that came out was the Star Spangled Banner.
So this was another kind of wink of history, maybe, since it actually was the Americans who were coming to power. That was quickly changed. Iranian music was put on. Zahedi made his speech, announced that the evil Mossadegh was gone, and I will now take over and restore Iran's greatness. The Shah was sitting at lunch in a hotel in Rome, probably thinking to himself what he was going to do now. He had already told people he would have to look for work, because he wasn't going to be able to go back to Iran. Suddenly, some news reporters burst in and handed him the news. They said, you're back. The coup, there was another coup. It succeeded. You're back on. You're going to be the king. He was in complete shock and for some time couldn't speak at all. Finally, his first words were, I knew it. They love me.
Back at the U.S. Embassy, the champagne flowed as jubilation reigned. The message the Dulles brothers took away was that they had a whole new way to shape world events.
After the coup, several hundred military officers were arrested, about 60 were executed. There was a purge of all officers who were deemed loyal to the democratic government and not loyal to Zahedi or the Shah. It was a way of cleansing the army and doing something that Mossadegh had refused to do, which is build an army loyal to the people in power at that moment.
For his part in the coup, Zahedi was paid $5 million by the CIA. The oil industry was denationalized. An international consortium was formed with 40% of the shares now going to American companies. Profits were split with Iran on a 50-50 basis, but the British effectively retained overall control, and its oil company renamed itself British Petroleum. Three months after the coup, Mossadegh was tried in a military court on trumped-up charges of treason. His fiery defense electrified the courtroom and is still remembered today.
اما خود من میدانم که یک گناه بیشتر ندارم و آن این است که تسلیم تمایلات خارجیان نشدم.
McCarthy era was a dark time in the United States. This was from about 1950 to 54, thereabouts, when McCarthy was on the scene. And he both was created by and came to symbolize this period of absolute fear of communism, excessive fear, hysteria, as it's often called.
I intend to go to those states and give the American people the cold documented picture of the sellout in Korea, the extent to which communism has been directing our foreign policy, our suicidal foreign policy, if you please.
It was a time that that created pressures against different American administrations, presidential administrations, to move their policies to the right. John Foster Dulles was one of the big proponents of rollback of communism under the Eisenhower administration. He had been, for a long time, an outspoken critic of Truman's policies about fears of the United States being soft on communism. And he is known for being a vocal advocate of pushing back hard against the communists. He later admitted that he tended to exaggerate the threat purely because it served certain interests.
I think the conclusion that the Soviets didn't have any real implementable, executable designs on Iran in 52, 53, 54, I think it's a pretty sound conclusion. But on the other side of that coin, an even sounder conclusion, I think, is that at this time, the so-called communist, the Tudeh, in Iran, was indisposed to be a lackey of the Soviet Union. Basically, they were an indigenous group, not a Comintern group, not a group that was recruited and funded and marshaled in Moscow and sent to Iran.
The ideas of communism were certainly very much opposed to Mossadegh's idea. You could speculate on whether circumstances might have changed over time and communist influence might have grown there.
The question of communism threat is often used as a rhetorical when it's useful. So in the early part, when the oil crisis starts, the Americans will keep pressuring the British to actually deal with Mossad there. And the Americans say to the British, if you don't deal, Mossadegh will be overthrown and the communists will... And the British poo-poo this and say there's absolutely no danger of that. We can pressure Mossad there as much as we want. There's no communist threat. Later on, you find that the British then say we have to get rid of Mossad there to stop the communist guy. And then people like Acheson are then repeating the earlier British poo-pooing that really there's no real danger of a communist takeover. At the time, of course, you can say the discourse in the West was the communist danger. So if you want to get anything done, you say that. Nowadays, you can say the discourse is international terrorism, and you can justify anything.
But even the Dulles brothers' view that this country was very susceptible to communist takeover is something that they developed themselves and is quite dubious from historical perspective.
Distortion we usually get in the conventional view of the coup is that it's a part of the Cold War, is the US-USSR rivalry that leads the CIA to carry out the coup. I would argue that the coup is really rooted in the oil crisis. When Iran nationalized the oil company, this was not just a threat to the British. It was as much a threat, actually, to all the Western companies, including the American companies, because the same thing could happen to American companies in the Middle East or South America.
The summer of 1953 was a turbulent time, and, of course, very threatening and dangerous for Mossadegh. Mossadegh's house should have been sacrosanct. It was not. And the mob went after it. I was horrified by the bloodletting in the streets. There were tanks attacking the house. There was a lot of killing then. 300 people died in that couple of hours. I interviewed the Shah amongst a group of reporters there, me and people from United Press and He just was kind of bubbling over with glee at having been saved. I met Kermit Roosevelt for the first time after the coup. I had several discussions with him later about, do you really think now that was a good idea? And he said, oh yes, it'd give us another 20 years or something like that. It was the most reactionary. He was obeying orders, Kermit was. I think he truly believed in his mission.
The 53 coup is like a guillotine in Iran. It inaugurated sort of massive repression, and it changed the landscape.
The 53 coup was clearly a big success for the CIA, as they saw it at the time, and it fit perfectly with the ideas of President Eisenhower, the Dulles brothers, and others who thought that covert operations was a very powerful tool in U.S. foreign policy. And it clearly served as a model or a you know, provided lessons for future operations, including the following year in 1954 in Guatemala.
You know, we in the United States have short memories. People in the Middle East never forget. And I think there's some political truth to that. And the Iranian people, I believe, know all about it. But the average American doesn't have the vaguest idea that we interfered with an elected government. What bothers me so much is that the American people believe that we can do no harm, that we are willing to go to war, start a war, to promote democracy with force. At the same time, sometimes when there's a leader in a country that's been elected, even in recent years, elected leaders in the Middle East, we don't like them, we don't support them. Well, the CIA for many years has warned about blowback. But I know that when I brought that term up in the presidential debates, it wasn't my term, and I referenced it to it having been established by the CIA, because they knew and understood this, that they can come back on us. It's an unintended consequence. We should know what went on in 1953, what happened with the coup there, but I think that the goal of all individuals ought to be to know the truth about our history, and not to hide from us. I think that when the history is distorted, I think we just continue to make mistakes. So history is helpful if we're honest with ourselves. I think that's the most important thing for any country or any people, is to be honest with ourselves. Because when your own government does harm and you ignore it or pretend it never existed or defend it for the wrong reasons, it's very detrimental.
It is necessarily nefarious. It's always engaged in overthrowing governments. That's false. That's for the birds. The government of Mossadegh, if you recall history, was overthrown by the action of the Shah. As far as I know, we don't engage in assassinations and kidnappings and things of that kind. As far as I know, we never have. I hope I have a reasonable moral standard.
Well, the Iranians were organizing themselves, and really all they needed was support and, to some extent, professional guidance.
Was my feeling then, it remains my feeling, that the British understood the extent of paranoia in this country concerning communism. This was the day of Joe McCarthy, and that the British consciously played on that fear in order to help persuade us to involve ourselves in the coup. What we did from Washington was to write some of the articles that would appear in the Persian press. And these articles would appear thanks to the Rashidians, who had contacts, I believe, with probably four-fifths of the Iranian press, and they were designed to show Mossadegh as a communist collaborator and as a fanatic, as a person who didn't understand that you could be both nationalistic and positive. These two agents saw the opportunity and sent the people we had under our control into the streets and acted as if they were too dead. They were provocateurs, but we had more than just provocateurs. We had a lot of shock troops who actually acted as if they were two dead people throwing rocks at mosques, at priests. That mob that came into North Tehran and was decisive in the overthrow was a mercenary mob. It had no ideology. and that mob was paid for by American dollars. And the amount of money that was used is, it has to have been very large.
The CIA prepared a report on how the coup had been carried out. It would serve as a guide for conducting coups in the future. But the report left out key details.
But even if we saw the full report, there were certain things the author, Donald Wilbur, wouldn't have put in there because it wouldn't have been kosher to put those in. Things such as the CIA working very closely with the Iranian Nazi Party, that wouldn't have gone very well down in Washington. He also doesn't deal with actually questions of assassination, which I suspect the MI6 and the CIA were involved. So that's sort of sanitized out of the report. I think that in the 53 coup, the CIA was much more involved in the actual mechanics of the coup than in other places like Guatemala or Indonesia and places. So there's much more very incriminating information, and that's why the CIA has been very reluctant to release the stuff.
With the help of American aid and training, SAVAK was created in 1957. Its name alone would come to strike fear in the hearts and minds of Iran's citizens.
Several of our students, you know, got refuge on the roofs, the fifth floor, the sixth floor. They threw them away, just threw them like garbage down. And many people got killed that way. Many people had broken legs or arms or, you know, being in the center of these torture chambers, hearing all of these cries and screams coming everywhere. I mean, I couldn't sleep for a minute, that 24 hours, because of this. I mean, you are in the solitary and this guy is screaming, kill me, don't do that, just kill me. And this, I mean, screams all over. It's filled your ears. This time they handcuffed me this way. There was this hook, and they could raise it so I could be kind of hanged off my hands, and the pain all over.
Any time you protest something
so bad, they beat me by 100 flags, and I get unconscious, and people, torturers would come and just to have fun. It was bleeding, my mouth was bleeding, blood was all over my body, and death would be, I mean, just a relief.
It's difficult for you to talk about it. It's a horrible experience. You don't have to if you don't want to, if you really want to.
I have a duty to say these things for American people to know what was like on the Shah.
At the time, this coup seemed like a great success. But let's look back at it from the perspective of history, from the perspective of today. The Shah ruled for 25 years with increasing repression. His repression produced the explosion of the late 1970s, what we call the Islamic Revolution. So, from the perspective of history, this coup doesn't seem quite so successful at all. A lot of history came out of 3 weeks in Tehran in the summer of 1953.
If I sit silently, I have sinned.
The coup of 1953 in Iran was only the first in a series of unwelcomed interventions in the following years. Less than a year later, in June 1954, the Americans conducted another coup in Guatemala. Thus started a chain of covert operations led by the CIA to topple democratically elected governments and replace them with puppet administrations. Each event has had far-reaching consequences and has left its mark on history. Well, that's it for this episode of Aperture, but do join us next week for another fascinating documentary.